Well, Jacob thought he was marrying one person, but he got two. He had served his uncle Laban for 7 years. He did it in exchange for Laban's beautiful daughter, Rachel. Laban had promised that after 7 years of service was completed, he would give Rachel to Jacob. But Laban pulled a fast one. He tricked Jacob in much the same way that Jacob had deceived everyone around him. Laban, in fact, pulled a Jacob on Jacob. And instead of giving radiant Rachel, as he promised, Laban gave lackluster Leah to Jacob. Now, in the end, Jacob got both women. He married the Rachel he wanted and the Leah he didn't want. That odd story is found in Genesis 29, 14 to 30. And I encourage you to read that if you haven't already in preparation for today. Now, if you're married, you know what it's like to be Jacob. When you said, "I do," you got the radiant Rachel you wanted. You married a Rachel who celebrates your greatest joys and shares your deepest sorrows, who loves you when no one else does, who services your car by changing the oil and installing new snow tires, who offers physical warmth and affection, who makes you hot soup when you have a cold, who plans special getaways on your anniversary and your birthday, and who puts presents under your pillow for no reason at all. You married a Rachel who convinces you that you are more valuable than you feel at the moment, who looks spectacular, not to impress anyone else in the room but you. A Rachel who sends you 2 dozen roses at work, who brags about you to your mother-in-law. When you said, "I do," you got the Rachel you wanted. But like Jacob, when you said, "I do," you not only got the radiant Rachel you wanted, you got the lackluster Leah you didn't want. You got a Leah who doesn't always embrace your inspired ideas. A Leah who leaves the toilet seat up so that you fall in the dark of night. Who uses your razor. Who gives you the silent treatment and then turns to scream in your face. A Leah who spends too much money on things that don't matter to you. Who complains about you to your mother-in-law. Who likes music you don't like and doesn't like music you do like. A Leah who forces you to dine at a steakhouse when you're in the mood for takeout Chinese. Who has a different parenting strategy than you do. A Leah who drives you nuts at times, makes you mad on occasion, and utterly confounds you on most days. God spoke to me through Lenny Lucchetti, who shared this message about a month and a half ago at the fall workshop for pastors on the Michigan District. I didn't know it at the time, but God had penetrated my heart through this message. And then I entered in very shortly after that my time of brokenness that I talked about a couple weeks ago. Lenny shared that he, with engaged couples, will share this little ditty. When you say, "I do," you're getting two. Now, if you've been married for more than a month, you know what I'm talking about. Most couples eventually realize that Rachel and Leah live in their spouse. And upon this realization, many couples end up either coexisting or quitting their marriage. There are some rare couples who learn to love not only the Rachel, but the Leah in their spouse. Their marriage is golden. It's a thing of beauty. Now, whether or not you're married, if you are part of the Church of Jesus Christ, you know what it's like to be Jacob. When you said, "I do," to God, you got the radiant Rachel you wanted. You got the Christ. A Rachel who forgives your sins, heals your wounds, lifts you out of the slimy pit, places your feet on solid ground. You got a Rachel who says, "Come to me," and readily receives you. You embraced a radiant Rachel who keeps the promise to never reject or leave you, who breaks the bars of your sin and shame, causing you to walk with your head held high as a disciple of Jesus Christ. You received a Rachel whose love gets you out of bed in the morning, whose presence gives you peace in the dark of night. The Rachel who gives you wisdom and purpose that you can't find anywhere else. Your Rachel finds ways to breathe life into your deflated sails found in your soul. When you said, "I do" to God, you got the radiant Rachel you wanted. You got Christ. But when you said, "I do" to God, you got not only the radiant Rachel, the Christ you wanted, but you also got the lackluster Leah, the church you didn't want. The church is a Leah that will disappoint us almost constantly. It's a Leah that fights and backbites, seems full of gossip rather than goodness, and appears more sinful than sanctified. It's full of quirky people you would never spend time with if you had a choice. It seems to major in the minors and minor in the majors. It's too racist, too sexist, too greedy, too traditional, too contemporary, too Republican, too Democrat, too restrictive, too progressive, too simplistic, or too intellectual. It sings songs you don't like and performs archaic rituals that you don't get. The church is a Leah that rubs you the wrong way. When we said, "I do" to God, we got the Christ and the church. A Leah that makes us wonder if getting Rachel is worth enduring Leah. Let's be honest. It feels a lot like God pulled a Laban on us Jacobs. Most of us come into relationship with God expecting only Rachel. And we get lots of Rachel. But we get just as much Leah. Who in their right mind would say "I do" to the mess and the risk and the failures and foibles and flaws that constitute the Leah we call the church? It's wise to caution engaged couples and new converts up front. We should tell them, when you say "I do," you're getting two. You get the Rachel you want and the Leah you don't want. Those first disciples realized that when they said "I do" to God, they got two. They got the radiant Rachel, the Christ they wanted. They also got the less than lovely Leah, the church they didn't want. They too got two. Here's how Mark records it. Mark chapter 3. Jesus went up on a mountainside and called to him those he wanted, and they came to him. He appointed 12, designating them apostles, that they might be with him and that he might send them out to preach and to have authority to drive out demons. These are the 12 he appointed: Simon, to whom he gave the name Peter, James, son of Zebedee, and his brother John. To them he gave the name Boanerges, which means sons of thunder, Andrew, Philip, Bartholomew, Matthew, Thomas, James, son of Alphaeus, Thaddeus, Simon the Zealot, and Judas Iscariot, who betrayed him. I need you to see that this passage is not a call to a personal relationship with Christ, but to communal relationship with Christ. Look at Mark 3:14 again. He appointed 12, designating them apostles, that they might be with him and that he might send them out to preach. Jesus designated them so that they might be with him. Jesus sent them out to preach. Mark's pronouns are singular, not plural. Jesus called the 12 to love and serve him in community, not isolation. That's why Mark took the time to list the names of the 12 men Jesus called into this community. Mark named them all, even pointing out details that show that Jesus had chosen quite a motley crew. That's where the Leah comes in. Although the 12 men that Jesus picked were all Jewish, they were rather diverse. There was Simon the Zealot. Now, as a Jewish zealot, Simon hated anyone or anything that reeked of Rome. Someone like Simon would never normally choose to follow Jesus with Matthew, the tax collector. Jewish tax collectors like Matthew were notorious for robbing their own people in the name of the Roman government and lining their own pockets. Zealots hated tax collectors. Now, this tension typifies what we find elsewhere in the Gospels. This motley community was not a peaceful one. The apostles argued about everything, especially about which of them was the greatest. They were jealous of each other. They tried to outdo each other. Now, what is so strange is these 12 guys left everything, not only to follow Jesus, but they left everything to follow Jesus in a community they would never choose if they could pick. Being with Jesus has its own obstacles. One of the most challenging obstacles, though, is following Jesus in community with people we don't prefer and who seem intolerable. Which one of us, Jacobs, would embrace community with Leah? Those first apostles may have initially thought, this is cool, I get to be with Jesus. Later, however, they realized that they got Jesus and a community that was frightening and frustrating. This community included Judas, the master manipulator, Matthew, the tax-collecting traitor, Peter, the know-it-all with an answer for everything, Simon the Zealot, who was always looking for a fight, and James and John, those sons of thunder, often more competitive than cooperative. Leave everything to follow Jesus with them? Really? Understand that discipleship in the context of community is messy. If you want to enjoy eating sausage, don't watch it being made. If you get up close and personal to sausage being made, the stench may very well get in your hair. The meat will get in your fingernails. The process of making sausage will probably gross you out. Sausage making is messy. Disciple making is messy too. If you want to enjoy the church, don't watch disciples being made in community. It's hard. It's uncomfortable. It's painstaking. It's long. If you get up close and personal to disciples being made, the mess can get on you and maybe even in you. Many who struggle the most with Leah, the church, have seen and engaged in the disciple-making of these Leahs. They are lay leaders and pastors, people who've given their blood and sweat and tears to Leah. Many of them conclude that the only way to be happy is to keep the church at arm's length. Tolerate Leah as Jacob did. Because if you really love Leah, she will drive you absolutely crazy. The more we care about Leah, the more she'll disappoint us. The more she disappoints us, the more we'll be tempted to either simply coexist with her or quit her. Maybe you've had moments when you thought of divorcing Leah. You had a close encounter with Leah. Someone who publicly and passionately displayed love for God during congregational singing, and then you saw them in a whole new light during the week. You saw Leahs who were quick to challenge people with memorized Bible verses, but seemed to slowly embody those verses. You got glimpses of sausage being made in community, a community that's sometimes contentious and cantankerous and callous. And you were tempted to quit the church and never return. Quitting the church is not the most prevalent escape. Coexistence is. Most Christians would never seriously think of divorcing Leah, quitting the church. Many just settle for a marriage of coexistence. They pay the bills with Leah. They share the household chores with Leah. They raise the kids with Leah. But there's no intimacy with Leah. They may share a passing peck on the cheek, but that's it. Understand that deep end discipleship simply cannot occur in a marriage of coexistence with the church. Some are caught in coexistence. They gave decades of their best energy to Leah. They invested the best of their time, talent, and treasures in the local church. At several points in the marriage, Leah burned them. She disappointed them. She didn't appreciate them. She didn't live up to their standards. So they slipped into a marriage of coexistence. They still attend church services. They sneak in late during opening songs and leave early just before the closing benediction. They don't want to rub elbows with a bunch of Leahs. They share the bills and the chores with Leah, but there's no intimacy. They tolerate Leah, but they critique her harshly. Disgruntlement with Leah has made them less like radiant Rachel and more like lackluster Leah. There are many people whose marriage to Leah, the church, is marked by coexistence. They haven't physically left, but they have internally checked out. They've been offended, hurt, burned, disappointed, dismayed, discouraged, and disillusioned. And deep in the bowels of their soul, where only God can see, they have thrown up their hands and said, "I am done loving," and will simply tolerate the church. Do you find yourself in a marriage of coexistence with the church? Do you wonder if getting Rachel is worth enduring Leah? Well, like it or not, when we said, "I do" to God, we got the radiant Christ we wanted and the lackluster church we didn't. They are a package deal. Now I ask us, who in their right mind would want to marry Leah? Jacob surely didn't. But Jesus did. One day, Jesus Christ, the groom, stood at the altar waiting for us to come to him. And as we made our entry, the musicians didn't play, "Here comes the bride, all dressed in white." But, "Here comes the sinner, all dressed in shame." None of us comes to Jesus looking like Rachel. We all come as Leah. We walk down the center aisle sporting a torn dress, evidence of a really bad hair day, and running mascara. We bear the baggage of our sin, shame, and struggle. Our Heavenly Father arranged this marriage to his son, and he paid the dowry with Christ's blood. Jesus, unlike Jacob, knew exactly what he was getting when he wed himself to Leah's like us. But God demonstrates his own love for us in this. While we were still sinners, Christ died for us. While we were still Leah's, Christ wed himself to us. And he did so with joy. Jesus knew what he was getting when he said, I do. He knew he was getting two. He was getting a potential infused Rachel and a problem infested Leah. He also hoped that his love for us Leahs would bring out the radiant Rachel that God had placed within us. The unconditional and unmerited love of Christ for less than lovely Leah, the church, makes it radiant like Rachel. When Leah is loved and loved well, despite all the reasons not to love her, it has a beautifying effect upon her. The Apostle Paul would agree. Ephesians 5, he writes, husbands, love your wives just as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her to make her holy, cleansing her by the washing with water through the word, and to present her to himself as a radiant church without stain or wrinkle or any other blemish, but holy and blameless. You see, Jesus' love for Leah makes her radiant like Rachel. I want and I wish the church were more Rachel, more like Rachel than Leah. But tolerating the church, criticizing it, rejecting it, and hating it will not change it. Loving this Leah will. And here's the punchline. Learning to love Leah will not only bring out the Rachel in her, it will also bring out the Rachel hidden in us. I'm not as Rachel as I hope to be, but I'm more radiant than I would be because I'm in a position to learn to love and not merely tolerate Leah, the church. You see, this is how God sanctifies us. Marriage is a sanctifying grace. It's the hammer God uses to chisel Leah's like us into Rachel's. Marriage to the church is a premier tool God uses to sanctify the human soul. Personal Bible study and prayer are soul sanctifying tools as well. However, Christian community is where the rubber of biblical application and prayerful submission meets the road. Some of the most gracious people in the world are found in the church. Some cruel people are found in the church also. And one of the hardest things about being a Christian is the church. We then tend to think of the church not as a grace, but as a curse. In the church, we don't get to pick who comes. We are forced to bump into broken people like you and like me, who have annoying idiosyncrasies. And this is precisely what makes the church such a sanctifying grace. Now, in the process of learning to love people we don't like and putting up with the good, the bad, and the ugly parts of Christian community, our sanctification is accelerated. Sanctification happens in the messiness of community. Sanctification happens when we love Leah despite her failures and flaws. When we love lackluster Leah, there will be less Leah in each of us, and therefore more Rachel in the church. Do you see the sanctification cycle? Do you see why in your brokenness you have a choice, bitter or better? And if you choose better, you then cooperate with the sanctification process God wants to do in you. Hebrews 10:25 says, "Let us not give up meeting together, as some are in the habit of doing." Because if we give up meeting together, we miss out on the sanctifying grace of Christian community. The community to which Christ calls us, it's frightening, it's frustrating, but it's formative. When we begin to follow Jesus, we not only enter into perfect community with Father, Son, and Spirit, Rachel, we enter into imperfect community full of broken people, Leah. And some of these Leahs think differently than you and I do about theology, about politics, about music. Some differ from you and me economically, educationally, ethnically. It's not the similarities, but the differences that form us most. Now, wouldn't Christian community be so much easier if we could pick our own church? You know, form perhaps a house church. You'd invite 12 people who are a lot like you. Same color, same educational background, same interests. They would enjoy the things you enjoy. They would think the same kinds of thoughts about God you think. They would embrace your culinary likes and dislikes. Ah, if such a church existed, we can almost hear Louis Armstrong breaking out in song. What a wonderful world. A church full of people who look and think and live like me would do very little to develop me into a disciple of true depth. Now, don't get me wrong. We can and should appreciate those friends with whom we have lots in common. But living in community with people I would not choose meets my most significant discipleship needs. It puts me on the cutting edge of spiritual formation. Again, Christian community, it's frightening, it's frustrating, but it's formative. It's the old guy who scowls at your kids because they're whispering during the sermon. It's the teenage girl who sits two pews in front of you surfing the internet on her phone throughout the message. It's the busybody who won't stop gossiping about people on the prayer chain. It's the pastor who makes decisions about worship services that fly in the face of your preferences. It's the senior citizen who implies that you're too young to have any wisdom. It's the young adult who suggests you're out of touch. It's the offertory singer who seems more bent on showcasing her talent than on glorifying God. We naturally want to run from a community like this. But then we realize we are who we are because of who they are. They are a sanctifying grace to you and to me. Christ has called us into a community we would never choose, full of violent zealots, egotistical sons of thunder, odorous fishermen, and a greedy tax collector. And God knows that it's not the smooth edge of the church that chisels off the rough edges in us. It's the rough edges of the church that file us smooth. Dietrich Bonhoeffer was a pastor and theologian who served in Germany during Hitler's Nazi regime. He wrote a classic book called Life Together on how to survive the church, how to love Leah and live to tell about it. The context for the book is a German church that's selling out to the nationalistic dream of Hitler's Nazism. And some of Bonhoeffer's closest friends, local church pastors, were buying into the German propaganda. They, like Hitler, began preaching a Nazi gospel instead of the Christian gospel. They were more interested in preaching German ideals than Christian values. Bonhoeffer had every reason to give up on Leah, but he didn't. Instead of giving people a license to reject Leah, here's what he wrote. Every human wish, every human dream that is injected into the Christian community is a hindrance to genuine community and must be banished if genuine community is to survive. He who loves his dream of a community more than the Christian community itself becomes a destroyer of the latter. Even though his personal intentions may be ever so honest and earnest and sacrificial. Now, to sum up what he said, Bonhoeffer asserted that when we hold on more tightly to our ideal community than we do to our real community, we can never experience the joy of the latter, the real community. We're sometimes tempted to abandon the church. We're tempted to quit or complain about the church. And then God reminds us that we got two when we said I do. The Rachel we wanted and the Leah we didn't. And we must learn to love them both. If you want to be happy in marriage, tolerate Leah as Jacob did. But if you want to be holy in marriage, love Leah as Jesus did. God's ultimate desire is to make us holy, not happy, so that holiness is our greatest happiness. God has used his people to deepen my relationship with him. In my growing up years, I was surrounded by men and women in the church who modeled for me lives of surrender and devotion through their commitment and their service. God continues to use the church to deepen my love for him. And I can tell you that through this time of brokenness, that statement is more true than ever. When we worship with one another, serve alongside one another, simply live life with one another, we learn more about God's creative nature. And Leah, though lackluster at times, has more than a few redeeming qualities. The church possesses more beauty than meets the eye. The problem that we're seeking to remedy here is that many of us come in with sky-high bars of expectation. And we anticipate that the church will be all Rachel and no Leah. And then we discover that there's at least as much Leah as Rachel in the church. And that throws many into a downward spiral of disillusionment from which some never recover. Yet it's our willingness to anticipate and accept not only the good, but also the bad and the ugly experiences of the church that leads to our sanctification. I want to affirm that there are many reasons to love the church, while admitting the realities of the challenges we face. Here's one of the premier benefits of loving Leah. And let me just add here now, the church and your spouse. One of the premier benefits. Despite all the reasons not to, when we love lackluster Leah, we get to experience intimate union with radiant Rachel, Christ. Put another way, the more we give to the church, the more we get of Christ. We can't keep the church at arm's length and expect intimacy with Christ. Many have tried and failed. If we want to experience Rachel, we must love Leah too. There's a direct relationship between my level of love for the church and my level of intimacy with Christ. This makes complete sense. If you want an intimate friendship with me, but constantly criticize my wife, forget about it. Ephesians 5, Paul says, Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her. Men, God has called us to love our wives. How? As Christ loved the church. What did he do for the church? He gave his life for her. If you are starving for more of Christ, try loving what he loves. Love the church and love your spouse.